The title of this talk today is Augmenting and Innovating Evidence-Based Employment Services. But since the center started in 1979, we did focus on recovery in general, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that, a little trip back in time as Judith did. So this is the center. We are located on the Boston University campus, which as it turns out is useful in a lot of different ways, including for our services programs, which I'll mention a little bit later. People with psychiatric disabilities prefer coming to an educational setting rather than going to a mental health clinic many times. And so it's been very useful to us for our services and now even more important for our college mental health programs, which I'll tell you a little bit more about. So the center was first funded, actually, Leslie, I think it was the National Institute on Handicapped Research.
I'm not sure we were that yet.
Oh, okay. Okay, and then at one point it was National Institute of Handicapped Research, and then NIDR, and then NIDLR. And so we were the first center focused on psychiatric disabilities to be funded in 1979, and we've been continuously funded as a research and training center since that time. Previously, the idea was that individuals who were given a diagnosis of a severe mental illness were thought to only have a downward trajectory. Unfortunately, that myth is somewhat still prevalent, but it was certainly very prevalent at the time of our first funding. The idea was that you could never work, you could never recover, you're a schizophrenic, and you'll always be a schizophrenic, and don't expect much from life. So many people got that message and unfortunately still continue to get that message a little bit. But our founding principle, and really Billy Anthony had a very interesting way of articulating this, was that individuals with physical disabilities can be rehabilitated. If you have a spinal cord injury and you're in a wheelchair, we teach you skills, and if we can't teach you a skill, we give you supports. And that equals rehabilitation, and that people with psychiatric disabilities were as entitled to and could benefit from psychiatric rehabilitation. It was a novel concept at the time, but he was able to convince NIDR at the time that this was a worthwhile thing to invest in. Our mission, believe it or not, since 1979 has essentially remained the same, and that is to help people live meaningful lives in the community, to exercise self-determination, to assume valued roles in the community. So a little something I wanted to play here.
I'm just a bad hearing.
So while we have a recovery process going on, and the facts and the people talking about it, what we've developed now is a new vision for this field. We've developed a new vision for this field so that we no longer think of deterioration. We no longer think of just maintenance. We think of recovery as a vision for this field. The thing to remember is that our whole field has been based on the fact that people don't recover. All right? All our systems, all our institutions, our training programs, everything in this field has been based on the fact that deterioration is the typical course. So I am talking about a vision here that consumers have suggested that we need a whole new vision for what can happen in this field. And we've named it recovery for the time being. Maybe a better word will come around at some time. But right now, I think we're talking about recovery. And we have a working definition of recovery that's based on the consumer literature and the literature of Dr. Harding. And what we talk about is the development of new meaning and purpose in one's life as one grows beyond the catastrophe of mental illness. Merely a working definition now, but something that we can all grab into. Well, I said this new vision changes everything. And professionals have a word for that. They call it a paradigm shift.
I think it's interesting and a little bit comical that he said, we'll try out recovery. We'll see if that word works. This video is about 20 years old, and so obviously the term recovery has continued to have great meaning. I think one of the things that Bill did with other colleagues at the center was really make the issue of recovery a very personal and yet very respectful quest that people would have. And so he talked about it as a deeply personal and unique process of changing one's attitudes, values, feelings, goals, skills, roles, a way of living a satisfying, hopeful, and contributing life. And the contributing life part of that is really important because it relates to our quest to help people with employment and to be community participants in a very positive way. He also said, and this was very personal to him because he had multiple sclerosis, still has multiple sclerosis, recovery transcends illness and the disability field itself. Recovery is a truly unifying human experience. All people experience the catastrophes of life, and the challenge of recovery must be faced. And so his analogies to physical disability, I think, really were very important pieces of philosophy and how to guide our services with this idea that it's a quest that everyone has to go through at some point in life, and that it's also very personal, and that we should be respectful of people's experiences. And that really has been something that has guided the center. Our work, our services, being very respectful of people's journeys. So a little timeline here that may be a little bit hard for you to read, but I'll just read some highlights. First funded in 1979. I think at that time we believed that we helped to lay the foundation for the field of psychiatric rehabilitation, articulate exactly what does psychiatric rehabilitation mean, what should it mean. We developed the values, the principles, practices, materials, and processes for how to get psychiatric rehabilitation out into mental health programs and to shift that paradigm. We began the Psychiatric Rehabilitation Journal in conjunction with the Psychiatric Rehabilitation Association, and for many years we called it our journal. It's no longer our journal. It belongs to the American Psychological Association, but we're very grateful to have had it. It's been a wonderful outlet for psychiatric rehabilitation and recovery-oriented services and research, and we're grateful to Kim and Susan for being at the helm of it for so long, for much longer than they ever anticipated. At the same time, in the 80s, we were developing a new model of supported education, which really was not prevalent at all in the country, as well as the choose, get, and keep model of supported employment. We hired peers as staff and advisors. We were among the first to do that. Our advisory council at the beginning of the center was made up of 50% individuals with a lived experience and or family members who had a child with a lived experience. That was considered quite innovative at the time. We developed, and I say we, it's Marianne Farkas, developed and implemented international training and consultation programs in psychiatric rehabilitation to help other countries move along and change, do a paradigm shift from the medical model to psychiatric rehabilitation. Bill actually named the decade of recovery. I don't remember what year that was. I know it was at least a couple of decades ago. And then we implemented something that's been really important for us for a long time. With the help of IBM, who does a fair amount of philanthropy, we developed a computer lab. So on the first floor of our building, we have a very sophisticated computer lab where people can come in, have their own personal computer station, have an LCD projector and an instructor. That computer lab has been so useful to us over the last 20 or so years. First, we were teaching people computer skills, and then we have been able to expand to do cognitive remediation and a career guidance program, and so it's been a very useful feature for us. IBM supported us for probably 20 or 25 years, and now we're supporting it on our own. We began to look at the issue of physical comorbidities. I see so many overlaps between what we all do. Realizing that people with psychiatric disabilities die between 5 and 20 years earlier than the general population. And we also believe that physical disability puts an upper limit on people's ability to recover in the best sense possible. If you're struggling with so many physical comorbidities, how do you ever live the best life you can? And so we began to do quite a few programs related to health and wellness, including a randomized clinical study of a nurse practitioner intervention. We developed and studied a variety of peer support services. So that has been one of the things that really has propelled us and engaged us in many ways, is to really look at how peer support services can be additive, complementary to the broader field. And one of our postdoc fellows who's here is going to be doing her fellowship research, Wallace, on the peer support experience in mental health settings. So we continue that avenue. We started to broaden beyond recovery per se to look at vocational recovery, spirituality, recovery promoting competencies among mental health practitioners. And then a very major initiative were several things that we started to do. Zlatka Rusinova heading this up in Photo Voice and using the methodology of Photo Voice to design and become the kind of the backbone of interventions that we were doing. And I'll mention a couple of those later. We continue now and in the future to focus on employment research, training and services, and to develop new tools for promoting employment and positive employment outcomes. We are expanding to study career guidance, not only in the research and training center that we're just completed, but also in the new one that we hope to start next week. We're looking at vocational peer support, vocational illness management, other augmentations, and I'll tell you a little bit more about some of those. Excuse me, I don't want to feel like Marco Rubio there. Missing his. So just a little bit about the structure of the center. I just am using this slide to show you that the Center for Psychiatric Rehabilitation is fairly large, and within it we have a research and training center on employment outcomes. I'm going to focus on that middle box, but I just wanted you to know a little bit about some of the other major initiatives, including our services, innovative services for adults with mental health conditions, and college mental health programs, testing cognitive remediation interventions. On the right-hand side of the big box, developing and testing a variety of Photo Voice interventions, all of which are peer-led interventions. And then the last one is a scaling up project that Marianne has, which is how to better scale up and sustain evidence-based employment practices in the wider mental health field. So I tried to give some thought to some of the things that have really affected our work over the years. And I'd have to say that that paradigm shift that Bill mentioned is probably underlies much of our work and much of the shift that the field has made. And that is this idea that we're moving from just being able to stabilize a person in the community to helping them recover and reclaim valued roles. The second was our initial foray into supported employment and supported education, the development of the Choose Get Keep model, the idea of providing supported education services to people with psychiatric disabilities so that they were not in segregated settings, but rather were enjoying the benefits of integrated educational programs. So that was a very big initiative of ours. And more recently, these hybrid supported employment and supported education models that we are very invested in and that Michelle Mullen is going to be helping us with to test out in our new research and training center. And I'd say the third really large initiative that has influenced our work and that we embraced was the peer movement. The peer movement, Nothing About Us Without Us, really influenced us in the 80s, and we took it to heart. And I would say that we have included peers in so many aspects of our work, not only in participatory action research, but as advisors, as employees, as individuals delivering interventions, helping us develop interventions. So that's been a major force in our work. Now, back to the issue of employment. I mentioned that the center, when we were first funded, we focused on recovery in general, in all of its aspects, physical, spiritual, recovery in general. But the last 10 years of our research and training center have been focused very squarely on employment. And so what we really needed to do is to kind of take a look at what does the evidence suggest right now about the deficits in our employment services, and what rationale do we have for moving forward with augmentations and innovations? You know, I'll just mention one thing that I think is an interesting story that I always reflect on when I think of where the field has come with supported employment and where I started out. I was a vocational rehabilitation counselor in Jersey many decades ago, and this story always stayed in my mind because it was so touching and so terrible at the same time. A man came to me who was an accomplished lawyer. He had a major psychiatric episode that made him unable to work. He very much wanted to get back into law. That was his passion, and he was educated to do that. And I had one thing to offer him, the McCarran Dial job, whatever, and a sheltered workshop. And so how do you tell a person like that who has aspirations that this is all that you had to offer? But the models that we now talk about of supported employment and, you know, even transitional employment were just not in existence at that point. So it was either that or nothing. And so I am so glad to think that we are so far beyond that, that we can think about careers and career ladders and supported employment in all of its varieties and manifestations to help people who want to go back to work and do something more meaningful. But what we know so far is that the jobs obtained through supported employment, all of the research suggests that they do not lead to what we call decent work. This is a definition promulgated by the World Health Organization. Decent work means kind of steady, steady work with some ability to move ahead, to maintain a decent salary, to have some tenure, and to have benefits. Almost none of the people that we see going into supported employment meet the criteria of decent work. They're almost always in episodic work, no benefits, and no job tenure, and certainly no career ladder. So that's something that we still need to think about. We also know that supported employment services are not widely available. Some statistics are 2% of the individuals who want supported employment can get it. That was a driver for some of the projects I'm going to describe to you. The other thing is that IPS and evidence-based supported employment often misses the individuals on the continuum that you might say are on this end of the continuum. They haven't articulated a goal of work, but yet there's some thoughts that they might want to get back to work. And so those individuals who are ambivalent about work, who lack confidence to think of themselves as a worker, or who don't have the explicit motivation to work, those individuals get lost in our current services, and so we'll be addressing that in our new research and training center. So altogether, what that said to us is we need to continue to innovate. We can't assume that we've got an evidence-based practice that does not need continued innovation, and we need to really focus on that to improve outcomes, to address career needs, and also the scaling up issue, and the engagement issue, engaging more people in supported employment. So the research that we've done for the last 10 years has really spanned all levels of the NIDLR research continuum, from the exploratory and the descriptive to developmental, developing interventions, intervention testing, and some kind of scaling up activities that resulted from those intervention development studies. We've conducted several randomized clinical trials of employment interventions. And we've done secondary analyses of data sets, like the mental health treatment study, in order to better understand what predicts employment. We also, and I say we, this is Westat collaborating with us, have done a policy study, actually a couple of studies, on the proliferation, I guess I would say, of supported employment, and what makes a state a high-performing state. I think Illinois is a high-performing state with respect to supported employment, but we also know, especially like the southern states, are not high-performing states. What is it that differentiates those states, and what can be done about it? So a little bit about the randomized clinical trials that I mentioned, the intervention development initiatives that we've taken on. These are all examples of interventions that we have developed, the majority of them with individuals with a lived experience, many of them delivered by people with a lived experience, and I'll just go through those fairly quickly. The first one is vocational illness management and recovery, taking off from Kim Muser's evidence-based illness management and recovery. We decided that it had a lot of valuable material about helping to educate people about how to cope. But what we wanted to do was tilt it in the vocational direction and say, what are the skills that people need to cope with work-related situations that may present problems for them? So vocational illness management and recovery was studied in a randomized clinical trial in three sites. And that study is complete. Thinking skills for work, Kim and his colleague and wife, Susan McGurk, developed an intervention designed to provide cognitive remediation in conjunction with IPS. And so in this last research and training center, we decided to take that intervention and make it a more portable, flexible, usable intervention so that it wasn't tied to a desktop computer, but rather a tablet, and hopefully to encourage people to keep using their thinking skills for work intervention. As you all may know, Thinking Skills for Work has multiple randomized trials suggesting that it improves outcomes over and above IPS. So a valuable intervention. We don't know exactly how it's going to work out with this current tablet study. We are conducting it here, though, in the city of Chicago at Thresholds with Nikki and Lisa and other people helping us. Thresholds has been a very good partner for us. Another intervention that we developed was this hybrid supported employment and supported education program that we delivered at our center. We know that many people want to pursue work and school at the same time, or people go between work and school. And this is particularly true of young adults. They might have a work goal, and then they change that to an educational goal, vice versa, or they want to pursue two at the same time. Our service systems do not allow for that. It's a very siloed system where supported ed is in one system and employment is in another. So our idea was to put it all under one roof where there's a great collaboration between the specialists who are delivering the services. And we found good outcomes in terms of engagement in work and school with this hybrid model. Funding it is probably another issue, which we have not tackled. The next one I want to tell you about is Vocational Empowerment Photo Voice. The idea with this intervention, kind of twofold. One is, how do we engage those people who are very ambivalent about work, who haven't said, I know I want to work, but there's some inkling there that that might be in their future, but they're insecure or they don't have a vocational identity, they haven't worked for so long. So this intervention was designed to empower individuals to pursue work and engage in employment services, even if they didn't want to work, if they would just engage in services, we would see that as a positive outcome, by enhancing their vocational identity and using the power of photo voice. So we've done a small randomized clinical trial that has shown higher rates of engagement in services, higher overall empowerment, and lower internalized stigma. And I'll just show you an example of the kind of work that comes out of this peer-led group intervention, where individuals are given a photo mission that has to do with their vocational identity, and then they're asked to give a narration to that photograph. So this individual said, my picture is of a wood-carved statue, a woman feeling successful. Her arms are extended straight up in the air. She is rejoicing in her success in finally finding herself. When I saw this statue in my cabinet at home, I immediately knew it was the picture I had to write about. This is me today. I have found myself, my career goals, who I am. It has all come together after many years of severe mental illness. Today, I feel joy, success, happiness, and love like never before in my life. So that's an example of how we really engage individuals in the process of exploring their vocational identity and hopefully improving it. A couple of additional augmentations and initiatives that we've engaged in that I think you may find interesting. When we were getting ready to do our research and training center 10 years ago, we heard from a lot of peer specialists who said, and peer advocates who said, yes, a lot of the people that I work with want to work, and they will say to me, can you help me apply for a job or go and get services or figure out what I want to do in my life? And most peer specialists felt very ill-equipped to address that set of needs that a person might have. So we developed a vocational peer support intervention and tested it out in a randomized clinical trial in Massachusetts and Arizona. And we found that the individuals who received the vocational peer support training were able to establish a better working alliance with the participants they supported in terms of establishing goals and a strong bond and working towards whatever their vocational goal was, as well as changes in readiness to engage in employment. The last one I'll mention is an intervention that we developed for this last five-year grant called Opening Doors. What we saw, similar to what I mentioned before, is that people who have some idea that they want a career-oriented job, it does not have to be a bachelor's degree or a graduate degree, but something other than a dead-end job, those individuals are lost in IPS, and usually when they go to the Department of Labor, they can be lost there because they have the psychiatric condition that they have to deal with, and people don't necessarily know how to attend to those issues. So Opening Doors was conceived as a group plus individual intervention where individuals would come to the center, to our computer lab in part, use a lot of web-based and internet resources, which were not heretofore things that we used, and that in combination with all those things, as well as some group process around talking about their past disasters with employment or their past successes, kind of move on and develop a career plan that would then be implemented with an individual coach. And so that study is just being completed. We're going to use a lot of what we learned in Opening Doors in our new project that we're doing with Michelle in Denver. Okay, this is a picture of all the people who were able to come to our State of the Science. I think we didn't have Portland there, but otherwise everyone else was represented. And it is a wonderful thing to be able to come together with like-minded colleagues and talk about our progress, so we're grateful for that. So a little bit now about our future directions. this is the announcement that came out for our research and training center saying that we would generate new knowledge to understand barriers and facilitators to improve employment outcomes, test models to improve outcomes, serve as a national resource center related to improving employment outcomes. So as you know, if you've done these kinds of things, you have to develop innovative projects that speak to the priorities. These are the priorities. I won't go through them in the interest of time, but I'll tell you a little bit about what we're going to be embarking on and what our future directions are going to be. So related to the issue of barriers and facilitators to accessing high fidelity from the perspective of multiple stakeholders, Vasudha Gidagu, who's here in the audience, is going to lead a very large qualitative study really trying to understand if people don't engage in IPS, why is it that they don't engage, and what are the factors that might be facilitative in the future. She's going to look at multiple levels, families, individuals receiving services, as well as administrative staff. I have to say that Darius McKinney has been absolutely instrumental in helping us do that study and get that idea off the ground, as well as Judith. In terms of the levels of research, this is much more of an exploratory and descriptive study. It's not a randomized clinical trial. We're not developing an intervention. We're really going to try to better understand access issues. The second one was also motivated by this issue of we know that IPS as an evidence-based practice is morphing over time. It's evolving, it's changing, it's adapting to the new needs that might be experienced in the field. But we don't know that there's any catalog anywhere or any typology of what those innovations and adaptations are. So the purpose of this project, it's fairly abbreviated. It's a one-year project designed to really catalog and classify what those adaptations are. Wallace Adams, our postdoctoral fellows, with her sociology background, is going to help us with that. So let me move on. Did you have a question, Michelle? It's up to you.
So in this project, are you thinking about when is IPS no longer IPS with so many of the adaptations? Like thinking about if you're looking at the evolution of IPS, when does it become something else?
Yes, I think that's a good point, and probably we would know that from fidelity issues. So once it's not meeting at least moderate to high fidelity, you might not call it IPS. But it's a good thing for us to think about. excuse me, the next one, also one that was Judith's idea. We had no knowledge of this before you started to inform us about this idea of performance-based incentives for IPS specialists. We know that one of the biggest barriers to high-quality IPS is that IPS specialists do not hang around long enough. There's a massive churning of the workforce. There's no career ladder. The pay is low. And so the question became what are programs doing about it? It turns out they're doing these things called performance-based incentives or bonuses, but yet nothing again is cataloged or described. And also we don't know really how it relates to eventual employment outcomes. So this is gonna be a really interesting project. Zlatka and Vasudha leading it. We're gonna be doing qualitative interviews, surveys, and looking at some of the data that's in the Illinois system to learn more about that. The last three projects that we're doing, the R4 is a pilot randomized study of an evidence-based cognitive self-management intervention. It's really one component of the thinking skills for work. It's gonna be done with thresholds. We're gonna be doing a randomized trial. What's interesting about this and what makes it a little bit, I put it in the scaling up area, is because normally thinking skills for work has been delivered by a cognitive specialist. So the question is, how do we get more mental health practitioners able to deliver this intervention and really integrate it into the day-to-day employment services? So we're going to be using IPS specialists to deliver one component of the thinking skills for work and test it out in a randomized trial. The next one is a really interesting project looking at this issue of metacognition and how metacognition may prevent people from doing the best that they can do in a work-related setting. So the idea is, I think of metacognition in my colloquial term as kind of thinking about thinking. So it's a kind of a level up, a person's ability to take the perspective of others, to understand what other people are going through, and then to hopefully use that information to have better relationships. It's going to be work-focused, and it's going to be developed with peer input, people with lived experience, and tested in a small randomized trial. And the last one is the project that I'm going to be doing with Vasudha and Michelle Mullen in Denver. We're calling it Fast Track, this idea that people need career guidance and career development coupled with supported education, but not only for those people who want to go to college. You know, mostly supported ed has been for people who want to go to college. If you're left out of that trajectory, then you're really nowhere that we can see. And so the idea is really, can we identify short-term training and use the principles and practices of supported education to help people succeed at this training so that they can get higher level jobs? So that's the research that we're going to be embarking on. Back a little bit now to knowledge translation from 2009 to 2019. This is a summary of some of the activities that have been going on, distance learning initiatives, workforce development for peers and state VR counselors, among others, online technical assistance to help programs embed recovery-oriented practices, technical assistance to IPS, states implementing IPS, and this was done in conjunction with the IPS folks at Westat, a heightened focus overall on employment and employment research, and training programs on employment developed for behavioral health providers. Some of the products that we've developed, phone applications, we're kind of going down that road of developing phone applications. The middle picture is of the cognitive remediation on a tablet, and allowing people to, we actually provided tablets for people so they could take the tablets with them and practice their cognitive remediation. And the last picture of our online technical assistance particulars. Some other products that were developed, information for families and clients about what does it mean to work and why should you think about working and how work can be helpful. We have an employment repository of informational materials for people and providers and family members all around the issue of work. This is a list of the new projects that Marianne and her staff are going to be embarking on in the knowledge translation or TDTA, technical assistance training and dissemination area. We're going to continue the National Resource Center to improve employment outcomes, create a mobile application to change provider work expectations. So we know mental health providers are often the ones giving the discouraging messages to people. You can't work, it's too stressful, your symptoms will increase. So this is designed to counteract that. We're gonna continue with the online technical assistance response, helping organizations use new knowledge to improve employment outcomes, our general technical assistance activities, an interesting project who's that's going to be delivered by one of our individuals with a lived experience who's a very, I would say, a master trainer in our field. Her name is Lynn Legere. She really wanted to see if she could train peer specialists to do a better job of helping individuals understand benefits. So she's going to train peer specialists who in turn can provide this information to the people that they work with, called Rise Up Above Benefits. And then a training project called Changing Hearts, Minds, and Practice that Marianne could speak to when we get to the Q&A. So very briefly, just to wrap up, some of the things that we think are important, not so much project-specific or content-related, but broader than that. We do feel that there is still a need to innovate around IPS and supported employment. We're not at the end goal of where we want to be, and so we should not stop innovating. We need to continue to focus on supported education interventions. They've been left behind in the push to IPS, and yet we really do believe that they're very valuable and they serve the needs of many of the people that we work with. But there's very little research on supported education. A continued focus on health issues, because we know that there's an upper limit to people's recovery when they're dealing with physical health issues. Continued focus on community participation. We have a DRRP focused on community participation, and we know that it's important for people to feel that they have a psychological sense of belonging and that they feel like they're of a community, not just in the community rather than in a group home, that they feel part of that community. So that's the focus on the DRIP, and a continued focus on, of course, sustainability, scaling up, and the use of web-based technologies. We can innovate all we want, but if we don't get information out there to change how the field operates, then we haven't done our job or the best job we can do. So that's a really important goal. And the last one is reducing the no-do gap, which you may all be familiar with, this idea that we innovate and only 18 years later do we actually practice that. The guy who developed the H. pylori antibiotic idea, I think it took him from the time that he discovered that ulcers were not caused by stress, they were caused by the H. pylori bacteria. It took 18 years for physicians to prescribe that on a routine basis. So whatever we can do to shorten that no-do gap and to disseminate, train, and assist people to do that will be to the benefit of all of us. Just a little bit about other things going on at the center. I'm going to go through these. I've actually gone through a lot of them. So I'll just mention a little bit about our services center, because I think it is unique among a lot of the research and training centers. We have a very large and active service division. We serve adults with mental health issues. We call that our recovery education center. We use recovery-oriented practices, but with an educational kind of structure so that people come for semesters and they learn different things about different aspects of wellness. That's our adult recovery education program. More recently, we have seen the need for college mental health interventions. We have a lot of college kids who are struggling in school, and in order to help them stay in school, we're promoting our college mental health interventions and programs, and that's growing quite a bit. All of those occur on the first floor of our building, and so they actually serve as an incubator for us so that we can kind of go back and forth between innovation, trying out new things, pilot testing, and in some cases even doing randomized clinical trials in our services division. We also have been looking at things like mindful eating. Vasudha, that is an area of interest for her. How can we address at least that aspect of lifestyle issues with people through a mindful eating intervention, which was developed, tested, and has been published on now? So that's all I wanted to say about the center. Let's see, I managed to go much longer than I expected, but I started late, so. So these are some of the contact people. This certainly does not represent all of the people who have contributed to the work here, but this is how you could get in touch with them about their specific interventions if you have any questions. Thank you all very much for your attention.